Being recorded. Welcome to today's Mental Health Minute teleseminar. Again, my name is Dr. Tom Unger. I'm a psychiatrist that works in Toronto at North York General Hospital, and I do a fair bit of education with the University of Toronto. This project is a project that is funded by the Canadian Council on Learning, and I'm very excited to have people on the phone with us from all parts of Canada, from coast to coast, including Whitehorse, Yukon, east to west coast, and that's wonderful. So thank you for taking the time to join us today. Our topic today is diet and mental health, and our guest today is Ms. Karen Davison. I'll introduce her in a few minutes. Karen, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. And our project manager is Annette Posé, and she's our technical support today as well. So I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about what the Mental Health Minute is. I mentioned to you our website, mentalhealthminute.com, so that you have some context for what we're doing today, and then we'll get right to our topic and to Karen Davison, who will talk to us about diet and mental health. The Mental Health Minute is a project to try to educate the public, consumers, providers, and the general public about mental health issues in a way that reduces stigma, that's easy to understand, easily accessible, with a variety of resources. So we have a website as a hub, as an educational hub, called thementalhealthminute.com, and it's hosting the teleseminar, and it will be posting some of the recording of today's session if you want to revisit it or if you want to refer anybody else to it. On our website, mentalhealthminute.com, you will find some information about various mental health conditions listed. We have very brief 1 to 2 minute audio minutes. I'm going to play one of those for you in a moment. We have video minutes, which or vodcasts, as we call them, and you can click on that if your computer can do that, and you can see brief video commercials that you can watch, which try to introduce mental health issues in a very friendly infotainment style. We also have some podcasts, which are about 10-minute information sessions, and then we're going to be posting some of our teleseminars, which will be about 45 minutes to an hour on there, should you choose to listen. So we're trying to be a support, a information service, and we provide a list of links to a variety of credible evidence-based organizations that people can refer to for good mental health information. So if you want information for yourself, for family members, for someone else you know, if you're a provider and want them for some of your clients, we're trying to make a credible yet friendly information service called thementalhealthminute.com. We were successful in getting a grant from the Canadian Council on Learning to develop some of these resources, and the teleseminars are part of this grant, and we are highly indebted to the Canadian Council on Learning for helping us, enable us to be able to provide this service and to help educate the Canadian public in this knowledge translation activity, as we call it. Our lead organization is the National Network for Mental Health, and we have project partners, other consumer groups, the Mood Disorders Association of Ontario, the Participants Council at North York General Hospital, and the Ontario Association of Patient Councils. So that's our group, and we've come together for this project, and we're very excited that we've been able to put together some audio minutes, video minutes, develop some treatment guidelines that you can print off through either our website at mentalhealthminute.com or through any of our partner websites, and enable us to provide the teleseminars for you today. I'm going to give you, many of you or some of you may have had a chance to visit the website and see some of our resources, but if you indulge me for a moment, I'm going to play you one of our audio minutes. It's about a minute and 40 seconds, and give you an idea of the approach and what we're doing. This one does relate a little bit to diet and mental health, so I thought I'd play this one for you. The segment is called Grapefruit Juice, and people may wonder, what does grapefruit juice have to do with potentially mental health? So I'll play that for you, and then we'll talk a bit, and I'll introduce Karen and get on to today's segment, and hopefully the grapefruit juice segment is a nice entree for us. So here we go.
Do you enjoy morning grapefruit juice with your breakfast along with a coffee? Well, unless you want to really be wired, there's something you should know. Drinking grapefruit juice can make drinking one cup of coffee pack the punch of three coffees.
Christine Chow.
Why? Well, it's because grapefruit juice blocks your body's natural ability to digest the caffeine in coffee, tea, or cola. You see, the same enzyme in the liver, the cytochrome P450-3A4 subenzyme, is responsible for naturally breaking down the caffeine and the grapefruit juice. But the grapefruit juice wins out, and the caffeine builds up, reaching much higher levels than it would have had you not had the grapefruit juice. The grapefruit juice can also interfere with your body's ability to digest and metabolize a lot of other everyday medications you might be taking. So if you find you're extra shaky, edgy, irritable, or not sleeping well at night, and you drink grapefruit juice with your morning coffee, you may want to find out more. But juice lovers needn't worry. Orange juice doesn't do this and is perfectly safe. If you or someone you know is on medication and drinks grapefruit juice, or you mix grapefruit juice with coffee in the morning, you can find out more by clicking on www.mentalhealthminute.com. I'm Dr. Thomas Unger with your Mental Health Minute.
So I hope people were able to hear that reasonably well. So that's an example of what we're trying to achieve and hoping the format is helpful to people. We'd love your feedback on it. On our website, on the sidebar, if you scroll down partway, there's a survey, a short survey, and if anyone has an opportunity, we'd appreciate your feedback on what we're trying to do. It's mentalhealthminute.maysurvey.sgizmo.com, and you just click right on the link, and it's a very brief, just click on survey, and so we'd love any of your feedback if you're interested. If you know or if you work with any other agencies, partners, consumer groups, really anyone you could think of, radio stations, TV stations, anyone who you think might be interested in getting these messages out there to help empower the public about a variety of mental health issues, please let us know, or please feel free to refer them to the site, and then they can contact us and help us try to achieve our mission of educating and empowering the public to make the best mental health choices and health choices for themselves, and perhaps even take some of the resources to their providers to maybe improve the care they're getting themselves. So enough about the Mental Health Minute at the moment. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today. Today we're very lucky to have with us Karen Davison from the Dietitians of Canada. And Karen's going to introduce herself, if that's okay, Karen, and then talk to us a little bit about diet and mental health. So Karen, thank you for taking the time out, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I thought I would, like Thomas Unger has mentioned, just tell you a little bit about myself and then get right into the topic that's of discussion on diet and mental health. So I'm a dietitian. I've been around for 15 years in practice, so I'm definitely showing my age here. And also, I've gone and done research in the area as well. So I'm in a period of transition where I'm finishing up graduate studies at the PhD level, where I looked at determinants of food intake in individuals with mood disorders. Mm-hmm. And moving into working at Simon Fraser University in the Center of Addictions Research and Applied Research in Mental Health and Addictions, and looking more at the relationships of diet and mental health, and that would be a postdoc. So my interest is mainly in the research, but because of my background as working as a dietitian, applying that research to everyday practice.
Fabulous. We're lucky to have you, Karen.
Okay. Thanks. So with this seminar, I provided a very brief handout, which just provides a framework of what I hope to discuss for what I believe is the next 15 minutes. Is that correct?
That's right. And attached with the participants' information that we emailed out, there should be a one-page printable file called Diet and Mental Health Teleseminar for people that they could have printed off or looked at that they should have available to them.
Yeah. So that just forms the framework of what I was hoping to discuss, and then we'll open it up to any questions. So when we think about the relationship between diet and mental health, there's a lot of different ways that we can look at it. And from a research perspective, there's a body of research that spans over about 80 years, actually, that has looked at these relationships, mainly from an interventional angle, so looking at specific nutrients and how they might affect different symptoms such as depression, impulsivity, hostility, aggression, manic symptoms, and anxiety, for example. And so I thought I would just start out with, when we talk about this, some of the relationships or mechanisms that have been looked at. And largely, this research is speculative, but can fall under four key areas. So the first is certainly one that you may be familiar with, and that's the role of serotonin or if you're referring to the handout, the 5-hydroxytryptamine system. And mainly what's been looked at here is the role of different nutrients and how it can affect that system. And there's two things that have come out of that research, and it's the role of what I call the trio of B vitamins, so vitamin B6, vitamin B12, and folate, and their role in modifying that system and the production of serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter that can have this calming and relaxing effect. Another key nutrients that have come out of that are the essential fats and their role in modifying this system as well. Another system is related to inflammation, and particularly the role of interleukin-6, and it tends to have these pro-inflammatory properties. And so looking at the role of what we call the antioxidant nutrients in influencing that system as well. So when I talk about the antioxidants, the main ones that have been researched are vitamin C and vitamin E, but there's also a number of different other compounds that you may be less familiar with that also have been researched. So things that such as the polyphenols, which are found, you may have heard of research in chocolate and research with green tea. Well, mainly what they're looking at there are the antioxidants and their role in health. The other system is looking at the adrenal medulla activity, and that has been largely researched with cardiovascular function and the ability of the nutrients to suppress adrenaline secretion. So this also falls into the area of mental health and hasn't been researched, say, as much as the 5-HT system, but it's certainly another mechanism that's being considered and its possible pathway to reducing behaviors related to impulsivity. Then the last is the corticotropin-releasing hormone, and it is thought to activate certain pathways which can increase fear and anxiety, and then that can lead to components of violence and impulsive behaviors. So those are the four main systems that have been investigated, and that's one way that we can look at diet and mental health because it somewhat forms the foundation of the direction of the research that's gone into looking at the different conditions and the role of diet. I also want to just talk briefly, it's the second bulleted item on the handout, looking at the levels of healthcare. So again, historically the research has looked at an intervention component, but now we're seeing a shift where it's also looking at prevention. So the role of nutrients in early brain development, the role that nutrients may play, for example, in school health. There's some exciting research that's come out of the U.S. where, the modification of diets or foods that are available within the school system can help in certain problem behaviors of schools that where violence might be a big issue and aggression and other problem behaviors. So just wanted to talk, just to mention that, and then move on into the next section where we're looking at the nutrition research in different conditions. So on the handout, I identify a number of different conditions where nutrition has been looked at in the research literature. Now, this talk could certainly go and talk about any one of those conditions, and I could take up the 15 minutes there. So I thought the approach that I would take instead is to give an overview of that literature and the common themes that have come out of it, so rather than talking about each condition. So there's 8 common themes that come out of the nutrition research. And the first, which I briefly talked about with the serotonin system, is the role of B vitamins, and those 3 B vitamins, folate, B12, and B6, and their effect on producing serotonin, and at the same time having an effect on reduction of the production of homocysteine, which you may have heard of if you've looked at the cardiovascular literature, that kind of thing. And so this has mainly been looked at in mood disorders, schizophrenia, as well as the Alzheimer's research. So there's this idea that this is a very important mechanism in mental health. Next, of course, are the essential fatty acids, which have gotten a lot of attention. And when we look at those conditions that are on the handouts, there has been research done in all of them, with the exception of autism, but there's research going on which just hasn't been published yet in that area. And so certainly the role of the essential fats, particularly the omega-3s, are thought to have this ability in prevention as well as in intervention in influencing symptoms around different conditions. Next is the role of the antioxidants. That's the third theme. And as I mentioned before, vitamin C and vitamin E have gotten a lot of attention in this area, as well as other compounds that you would find in a number of different fruits and vegetables, green tea, wine has also been looked at as well. So there's research that's going on in that area. Fourth theme is that around nutrient deficiencies. And I think probably the largest role that is where that is seen is in the substance use disorders. So if we look at it from an intervention angle, certainly a lot of nutrient deficiencies can come into play, which affect functioning. Different ones have been investigated, and the most common ones have been vitamin A, B1 or thiamine, vitamin B3, folate, vitamin B6, vitamin C, D, and K, as well as certain minerals such as zinc, magnesium, and iron. So certainly the correction of those deficiencies plays an important role in the treatment of these conditions. The fifth theme is looking at things that can precipitate, dietary factors that can precipitate symptoms. So this has mainly been in the area of anxiety and anxiety disorders, as well as in the attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. So, for example, with the Mental Health Minute recording that we heard earlier, the role of grapefruit juice and how it can influence the role of caffeine. Caffeine's been investigated in itself, as well as sugar. And so there's some information that is certainly known and in that area, and ongoing research that's been going on as well. The next is a theme that I refer to as oxidative stress, which ties back to the antioxidants, the third theme that I talked about, but talking about this more of dietary factors that impact on oxidative stress. And there's been a large body of research, particularly in the Alzheimer's disease, that looks at lifelong issues around weight, particularly obesity, and its association with the development or association with Alzheimer's disease. Whether what role it plays is not exactly known. There's been other factors such as the role of saturated fat, trans fatty acids as well, that have been looked at. The seventh theme is what I call the advanced glycated end products, and this mainly has been in the Alzheimer's research. And I take this out specifically because I think it also has implications for other mental health conditions. So these are sugar protein compounds that are related to the formation of plaques in the brain. And historically, the research has pointed to that our body naturally produces these, but more recently it has shown that diet can modify the production of these and the pool that exists within our body. And so the main foods that have been looked at there are those that are highly processed and exposed to high, dry heat, and that they can contribute to this pool of the advanced glycated end products, or AGEs that we call them as well. The last theme is around gastrointestinal health, and you may wonder, well, what does that have to do with mental health? And the main thing that's looked at, examined there, is fiber and its role, which can take toxins out of the body so that they are not absorbed, and then they cannot cross the blood-brain barrier and have a negative effect on brain health. So those are the eight common themes that have been looked at. Now, I also think that when we talk about diet and mental health, we have to consider other risk factors that come into play. So things in the environment, such as issues of poverty, social isolation, other medical conditions that may also be occurring at the same time that have an impact on nutrition, and then, of course, nutrient-medication interactions. Again, we could talk about any of these for the next hour or two, but I'm just going to highlight certain things. So the most common medical conditions that come into play with mental health include obesity, type 2 diabetes, high blood cholesterol, liver and kidney conditions or problems, infectious diseases, and so these can present overlapping and interacting risks with nutrition as it influences mental health. Another huge issue is that of food accessibility, and when I talk about that, it's the access to nutritious, safe, personally acceptable, and culturally appropriate foods, and that are produced in an environmentally sound and socially just way. And so this certainly impacts not just a mental health population, but when we think about certain ways where these relate to one another, with mental health, homelessness can be a key issue. And so when we think about food security, certainly they may have access to food, but it may not necessarily be safe food. So that's another key consideration when we talk about diet and mental health. And then, of course, there's the drug-nutrient interactions. So there are certain medications, that, such as the antipsychotics, that can influence appetite and weight and lead to other medical conditions. Many of the psychiatric medications as well heighten the need for folate, and so that can be an issue. There's others that can be involved in vitamin D metabolism, calcium, and bone status. There's a number of different nutrient drug interactions, so I'm not going to go into depth about any particular one, but just so that you are aware of that. Related to the idea of medications, there is the other options for treatment that include alternative or complementary therapies. And this falls into the area of nutrition in that this can include the use of vitamin and mineral supplements, herbal remedies, or you may have heard, for example, the term orthomolecular medicine. So when we look at these alternative therapies, there's over 50 different substances, and they can, that's individual substances that can be used, and there's any number of different combinations that are out there as well. And I just briefly want to mention this in that although there is steps that Health Canada is making towards the regulation of these, some of them are still unregulated and can be obtained from sources where you're really not sure what you're getting. So you need to be careful about that. And if you are considering the use of these substances, that you really need to, there needs to be discussion with your mental health care provider so that they're aware that you're exploring these and how that fits into your overall treatment plan. So now, from all of this information, I just want to finish off by summarizing how we can bring this down to a practical level. So if you are, say, a consumer in mental health, or if you're working with people or supporting someone, what would be, how could we summarize what would be a best diet? So I'm hoping that out of my talk that you've got the message that no one nutrient is going to offset mental symptoms, but rather it's a combination of different nutrients that you're going to obtain from a diet that is varied, so includes many different foods from all the different food groups, that emphasizes high fiber, and that also emphasizes low fat. And so when you use this approach, it can affect brain cell health, blood vessel health, and gastrointestinal health, as well as help to prevent conditions such as obesity, type 2 diabetes, and high cholesterol. Also consider how the food is prepared. And so when I was talking about the advanced glycated end products, looking at ways of preparation that would emphasize boiling, poaching, steaming, stewing foods. Also to be aware that you shouldn't cut fat completely out of the diet, but that you need to know of the different types of fats and emphasize the essential fats, which you can get from cold water fish, for example, as well as different vegetable oils such as flaxseed, soy, and canola. Also consider the antioxidants, and particularly the vegetables and fruits are rich sources of this, and you want to look at those as consuming a rainbow of food items, so fruits and vegetables that are dark green, red, orange, and purple. And then to also make sure that you're getting plenty of the B vitamins, which are widespread throughout the diet. You can get those from lean meat, fish, poultry, legumes, such as the dried peas and beans and lentils, whole grains, your fruits and vegetables, and also fortified soy products. So I'd like to just end with a quote that I'm sure you've all heard of by Hippocrates, where he said that let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And so the emphasis being that it's not one individual nutrient, but it's rather looking at the whole diet and how it can affect mental health.
Fabulous. Thank you very much, Karen. There's so many things you said in there. We've had a few questions emailed into us, and I think they relate to some of what you were speaking about. So maybe I'll just start with a few of those. You talked about the accessibility to food, which is not something we often think of in terms of diet, mm-hmm. but in terms of people in mental health, particularly people with serious mental health conditions getting food, but even the general public, the cost of good, healthy food, our fast foods are maybe not prepared in the healthiest manner, and if you want better food, it gets very costly, particularly people living in Canada and further out communities and in the north. Getting fresh fruit and vegetables is quite costly. I don't know if you could comment on that or any thoughts you have about that.
Certainly, yeah, food accessibility is an important issue, and it's one that's driven by a lot of different factors, some that are beyond our control, such as political factors, and it is a huge issue, especially in the mental health context, where, poverty can be an issue and this accessibility to foods. Now, there's certainly a lot of community development activities that have gone on around addressing this issue. And so I think the only comment that I'd like to make there is that to explore these programs such as community gardens, community kitchens, food co-ops. Mm. There's a recent program that was introduced here in Vancouver where people can go out to the farmer's fields once they've, taken their crop in after the season to get access to those foods that, such as the fruits and vegetables, which can be more costly. So considering maybe those type of avenues to help in getting access to nutritious food.
That's great. Yeah, I've heard of some even healthcare institutions allowing the volunteers who are looking for things sometimes to do to really help out to start herb gardens or other fruit or vegetable gardens. And it's quite a neat way they can contribute. I don't know if you're familiar with any of those sorts of other interventions like that.
And those I'm familiar with. And another one that I'm a little bit involved with society here is the involvement with organic foods and the delivery of that, and just being aware that of that option and of the foods and learning about those and healthy foods, and in doing that they can help to get access to those products as well.
Great. We have another question, and it's really relating to how do you know if you might be deficient? You've mentioned a number of vitamins and other nutrients that may contribute to our mental health. How do we know if we may be deficient in something? Is there any type of nutrition screening tool you know of or could think of?
Okay, so there's kind of two parts to that question. So how would you know that you're deficient? So there's a number of different ways that you can look at that. I would encourage that certainly connecting with a dietitian who can help to assess a person's diet. So for example, writing down for a few days what you've eaten, and the dietitian can help to pinpoint any issues that may come from there. And then, of course, there's also looking at blood work. Now, that's limited to some degree in that you can't look at all of the nutrients, and so that's why I also suggest that work with the dietitian, because some of the blood work, the values may be due to a number of different factors that can include diet. As far as the nutrition screening tool component, I'm not aware of any screening tools that are specific to the mental health population. There are screening tools that have looked at seniors and nutrition issues there, but I'm not aware of any that are in the mental health population, and someone else may be aware of that. But there's certainly some work that's recently come out of the UK of some questionnaires. I don't know whether the validity so much around them, but just making reference to those, there's some really good questionnaires that look at many different aspects of diet and mental health, and that more of a health professional can use in working with a client.
Right. Another question. Some people think that, or have asked about whether or not some of the mental health problems we have in society that people come with are really because their diets haven't been good. And is that the cause? And had we known that, would we be, maybe we shouldn't be medicating everybody? And that idea. Just any thoughts about that one? That's a bit of a hot potato.
Yeah. when I think about mental health, there's many different factors that can influence it, and diet being one. There's genetic factors, there's environmental factors. So certainly when I think about the treatment for mental health, I think the standard from my perspective is, of course, medication, and that diet can help enhance that part of it. So it's not necessarily a treatment in and of itself when I talk about diet, but that it's part of an overall plan which would include the medications and diet and cognitive behavioral therapy, those kind of things. I'm not sure if I'm actually answering that question.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I think that it's particular to each person, and they need to talk to their provider, because just some caution, if somebody suggests to you the whole, all your problems are due to this one thing, always make sure you're getting credible, good professional or provider care before you necessarily believe that. I'm not aware of any magic bullets in my diet to correct everyone's mental health. So
exactly.
Okay. You mentioned medications can help, but on the other hand, some of our medications, you mentioned antipsychotics, and some harmful things you've seen them maybe contribute to. I wonder if you could comment on that for a minute.
Right. So probably the one that is most commonly recognized are the antipsychotics that can certainly contribute to appetite and weight gain. And the exact nature of that relationship, is thought to be around the control of food intake, and then also around insulin resistance. So there's certainly that relationship, and there's ways that can be prevented. So those, and the most common ones when we think about the medications are olanzapine and some of the schizophrenia medications. So again, I'm not really sure if I'm answering
because it's
such a broad area.
Yeah, people ask exactly what the mechanism might be for the antipsychotics, and people, because they can cause some weight gain and elevated cholesterol and blood lipids and triglycerides, and if we know why that might happen and what might be going on there.
Right, and so certainly the mechanism that is thought is the influence on the hypothalamus and its control over food intake, and the hormone leptin that is involved as well. And so there's there isn't the feedback from the brain that you are full. And so it does have this effect on appetite, that it certainly encourages one to eat more. And then that can fall into other areas where you, of course, get the weight gain and then the insulin resistance that can come out of that. And then that trickles down into, say, the development of type 2 diabetes or altered blood lipids. So that's what the mechanism is thought to be. And so certainly there can be interventions around that, such as the selection of certain foods that can provide a lot of satiety, such as the high-fiber foods, to help that feeling of fullness and gives that delayed time frame. And also looking at other lifestyle interventions, such as exercise, to help control any weight gain.
Mm-hmm. Great. You mentioned a number of vitamins, the B vitamins, C and E and K. People often go to their health food store, to their pharmacy, Shoppers Drug Marts, whatever, and get themselves some medication.
Teresa Bartlett.
Or supplements. Is there any danger in taking these or taking too many of these?
Of the different supplements? Certainly, if it's something that you want to do on your own, I do believe there is danger there. So certainly there's been, say, reported cases where taking high-dose vitamin mineral supplements, say in bipolar depression, can trigger manic episodes or can trigger certain negative behaviors such as impulsivity and that. So you want to be really cautious about the use of these and to work with your mental health care provider, whoever that primary person may be. It may be your physician or psychiatrist, if you want to explore those so that they're aware that you're trying these or that you want to try these, and to be carefully monitored while you are on trying these different substances. So I would really encourage people not to just go out and try these on their own, but to work with their healthcare providers if they want to explore that option.
Mm-hmm. Great. So what I think we'll do now, we'll take a few questions. Somebody's on the line there?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah,
regarding vitamin supplements.
Go right ahead.
I'm a first-year nutrition student at Ryerson, and I was told that omega-3 has to be taken with the right ratio of omega-6, and I was wondering whether omega-3 is recommended. And obviously, you'd have to look at, do a dietary assessment in order to see whether or not the person is getting enough omega-3. But if they aren't, would we recommend omega-3? And if so, how do we get intake such that the ratio between omega-3 and omega-6 is right?
Okay. So let's begin with the ratio. So, yes, there is an ideal ratio between the omega-6 and the omega-3. So if we think about the Canadian population, the ratio in terms of population food intake has been about 20 to 1, which is very imbalanced. So for every unit, say, of the omega-3, there's 20 units of omega-6. We like to see that closer to a ratio of around 4 or 3 to 1. So certainly modifying, bringing down the omega-6 and emphasizing more of the omega-3. So if we look at it from a dietary perspective, the omega-3s mainly come from the cold water fishes, such as sardines, albacore, tuna, those type of things, as well as some of the vegetable oils, such as flaxseed oil, canola oil, as I mentioned before. Now, I think the second part of your question was, so if someone is not getting enough, whether to look at supplements. Is that correct?
Yes.
I don't.
Yep. Okay. And so certainly that is something to look at. If someone is not getting enough of that in their diet, and it should be carefully assessed. And again, working with, say, a dietitian, in that respect, to examine the diet and then see if supplements would be an option. There's been a lot of research around the essential fatty acid supplementation in different conditions, and it seems to be quite promising, but at the same time, there's a lot of questions that are left unanswered, such as what is the proper dose, and is it actually the, say, the essential fats, or is it some other cofactor in the diet that's influencing that? So when we think about essential fatty acid metabolism, there's a lot of different nutrients that are involved in that. And so whether it should just be an essential fatty acid supplement in itself or combined, say, with a vitamin mineral supplement. So there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered that. So I think my bottom line suggestion is looking at the diet and seeing where the omega-3s can be emphasized there.
Great. Thank you for your question.
I'd actually like to add something else. When we were talking about food insecurity, I want to recommend a cookbook called The Basic Shelf, which has low-cost recipes, and with the recipes comes the cost per serving. And I think it's a really great cookbook for anyone out there.
The Basic Shelf.
On a tight budget. Yeah, The Basic Shelf.
Great. Thanks for your comments. We appreciate it. Any other people want to ask us a question? Feel free to unmute yourself. Go ahead.
This is Wendy. I would just like to inquire. You mentioned 50-plus individual substances of complementary and alternative therapies. Could you just comment on maybe a few of the ones that you're aware have the most research supporting them or that are the most usually used?
Sure. So there is a number of different ones, and the ones that seem to come out of the research as showing most promise in terms of influencing mental health symptoms certainly is our tryptophan, which is what we call a neurotransmitter precursor. So it has a role in the production of serotonin. Tryptophan is an amino acid that's found in protein foods. So that's one, and certainly that has been used to some extent in treatment, but certainly after exploring other options. Certainly the essential fatty acids is another one that seems to show promise, but as I mentioned before, there's still a lot of unanswered questions such as dose and types and what other influences there may be in the metabolism of essential fatty acids. Another one is S-adenosyl methionine, or SAMe, that's referred to for short, which shows some promise in depression, but it should not, for example, be used with bipolar depression. Those would probably be the main ones. And then, of course, B vitamin supplements. And I refer back to, of course, the folate B12, B6, which can that show promise as well. So those would be the main ones that seem to have the most support.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Now, just to clarify, does the research or evidence support any of those as a standalone treatment for any of the conditions at this point?
No. So they're I would emphasize that they're possibilities, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions around them.
Right. So, or maybe good add-ons to the other treatment. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Anybody else with a question out there?
I have a question about children.
Go ahead.
Children and antipsychotics, and about the are there any studies or are you familiar with anything about the long-term effect on their, like with weight gain and all the complications that follow with seeing elevated cholesterol in children as young as 10? I work at a pediatric center, and that's always a concern when we're seeing those types of lab values when they're sometimes even pre-adolescents.
Personally, I don't do a lot of work with children. It's more so adults. And I'm not aware of any research that has come out around that, looking at antipsychotic use at very young ages and what its implications are for later life. Certainly, intuitively, you would think that, yes, you know, there is influence there, but I don't think it's been formally investigated in terms of the implications and the extent of problems that may come out from that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. I thought I would ask anyway.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to study, but thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, it would certainly make an interesting study looking at the longitudinal effects, definitely.
Yes.
Great. Thank you for that question. Anybody else with a question for us? Hi.
Hi, I'm Mari, and I'm a nurse in Vancouver looking after monitoring the psychiatric patients while they're on their meds for lots of things. But I just thought of a question, and that is, so for the nurse in the child pediatrics clinic that just phoned in, would they automatically guide the families on a nutritious, healthy diet while the kids are on, knowing that they're going to gain weight, knowing that their mood's probably low, knowing that they're functioning probably less actively than some of their peers? Is that part of their ongoing guidance for families?
Okay, so interesting. We've had a question from one listener to another one of our listeners, so I don't know if the other one wants to jump in and see if that answer that.
Hi, I'm back.
Go ahead.
We generally do that. I'm actually a dietitian.
Okay.
So usually we've started a program where I'm working that children who are at risk for the weight gain, if they're put on the medications and or at risk of elevated lipid levels, where they're put on kind of a healthy, we call it a healthy lifestyles program, mm-hmm. that we look at diet and as well as activity. We have a recreational therapist where I work. It's happened all along, but we've made a formalized clinic here. Sometimes, though, the children have been prescribed these medications. We do residential and outpatient treatment. A lot of times they come to us because we're a tertiary center. Once they've already been prescribed the medication and sort of the weight gain's already happened and a dietitian hasn't been involved, it's usually their GP and or a psychiatrist maybe in the community. Mm-hmm. So we do put them on these programs. There's lots of evidence with a dietitian, and she's also a therapist. Her name's Ellen Sater. Mm-hmm. And I've been to a few of her workshops just about children and obesity in general and about if you try and, it's difficult, but if you try and, what's the word I'm looking for, control what children are eating, then they sort of lose their own inner cues for society. So then it sort of rebounds because they usually have, the children I deal with anyway, besides having mental illnesses, they also have severe emotional and or behavior issues. So they're quite tough cases with who we're dealing with, and the craving for food and things like that sort of escalate the problems that they have. So it's quite a complicated process that the poor children are involved in. I don't know if I've really answered your question.
Well, you have. Thank you. And I'd say that also with adult populations, it's the same, that I see people who have already gained 100 pounds or so, and often they are resistant to change as well, and partly financially. So, yes, it's not the only group that doesn't want to change what they like and have always eaten. So, but thank you for your comment.
Yes, and food security is a huge issue with our families, too, because the parents are sort of doing the best they can, and it's usually lower socioeconomic, mm-hmm. and it's difficult for them to get out of that cycle as well. So mm-hmm. Usually with the kids I see, it's usually 50 pounds. It just seems mm-hmm. to be amazing that it's always 50 pounds within months. And it's really devastating for them. But the meds are working, so the kids, like the parents don't want the kids to go off the meds. But then the physicians are like, wait a minute, they can't keep gaining the weight, even with our interventions. Sometimes it just keeps happening, and it's devastating that way because sometimes they have to go off the meds because of those side effects.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you, and that was really neat to have two callers talking to each other. We've lost total control of what's going on. anybody else with a question out there for us? We've probably got about 5 minutes to go, so any other questions for us?
I have another one if there isn't.
Sure, go ahead.
I really appreciate the framework within which you presented such a vast body of information. When it comes right down to the basic presenting of information to individuals or to the public in terms of, you know, giving public talks and radio interviews and so on, do you have you developed specific informational guidelines about foods, you know, when we get right down to the supper table kind of thing? And if so, is that something that we could access?
Yeah, in terms of the Mental Health Minute and the project, our Canadian Council on Learning project, that is not a tool that we've developed yet, but it's a fabulous idea and eminently practical, and definitely something we should think about. If you have suggestions, again, please go on our survey on the website, on the mentalhealthminute.com website, and fill out our survey and give us that feedback, because that's really, really useful. I don't know, Karen, if you have any...
The only thing I would add to that is with the handout that I provided, I highlight some selected resources. And the one I just would like to draw your attention to is one from the Mental Health Foundation that's out of the UK. And certainly on that website, there is a PDF file that really, it goes into all the different areas and talks about specific foods. So I would encourage anyone to just take a look at that website, because it's really got some great specific information.
Mm. Fabulous. And I think, given what I've just heard, is that perhaps the link to that website, just to make it easy for people, that we should, we'll work on adding that. We have a series of links on the mentalhealthminute.com website for good, credible links, and perhaps we should add a link around diet and food and mental health. And if what Karen's telling us, if you recommend that one, perhaps we'll add that to our list. And make it easy for people just to access that through the hub.
Good. That'd be great.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Great idea. Anybody else before we wrap up? Last question?
Hello.
Hi, last one. Go right ahead.
Yeah, from the interest, I'm a consumer.
Yes.
And I've put on a lot of weight over the years, and I'm trying juicing to lose weight, and I want to know if it's a good thing to do.
Trying to lose weight. You gained that weight as a result of the treatment, you think?
Most definitely. Lithium.
Uh-huh. Karen, I don't know if you want to take a comment on that one.
I'm not sure if I quite got the whole question. You're wondering if, just so I'm clear, if juicing is an option for loss of weight?
Well, yes. I do that now for nutrition value and motivation, and it gives me more energy.
Mm-hmm.
I use vegetables mainly. But I don't use much fruits.
Okay. Well, certainly that's an option, you know, thinking that the source being fruits and vegetables for juicing can certainly provide the nutrients that you're looking for. The only, I guess, caveat I would say to that is it may not give you a lot of satiety, like the feeling of fullness. Which, you know, actually eating the whole fruits and vegetables has the fiber and that component to it, which could help with weight loss.
Okay.
So just something to consider.
Okay, thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. So I think I'll close off the questions at this point. I know we could go on for quite a while. I'm just going to ask the last one. Karen, is there any magic bullet food that we can take for better mental health? Any single thing that you will do it all for us?
No.
Okay.
It's more of a varied diet, and certainly emphasizing low fat and high fiber, and the emphasis being on variety so that you are getting all of those different nutrients, because your brain there's a lot of different reactions that go on that needs different nutrients for that, and so you need to be able to get all of those nutrients into your diet, which you'll only get through a variety of foods.
Fabulous. I'd like to thank everyone for taking the time out to be here with us today. I think we're at the end of our time, and Karen Davison, I highly appreciate your time to join us for today's Mental Health Minute Teleseminar. Thank you all for taking time out from coast to coast, to north to south, across the country, and I think this was a fabulous seminar. We should have an audio version up on the mentalhealthminute.com website, and again, please feel free to visit the site, fill out the survey, give us feedback. Hope everyone has a great day, and be well.
Kathy Tapley Milton.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.